States against Wren. Ms. Prasad.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Vinayaka Prasad, and I'm counsel for defendant appellants Adolfo Wren and Anthony Moten. I would like to start our discussion this morning about the benefit that should be provided to cooperating defendants from the new retroactive crack cocaine guidelines with the hypothetical that's presented at the end of the government's brief. In that hypothetical, the government advocates arbitrarily providing only those defendants convicted of more serious offenses with an additional reduction. It offers this hypothetical to address the fact that the new guidelines commentary specifically includes, for consideration for a reduction, defendants receiving a sentence below an otherwise existing statutory minimum in order to reflect their substantial assistance to authorities. The government states that while Mr. Wren and Mr. Moten cannot benefit from these reductions, it can provide an example of one defendant who can receive that reduction. And that defendant is a defendant who started with a higher offense level, indicating a more serious crime, whose overall guideline range is higher than Mr. Wren and Mr. Moten's, and whose new guideline range remains above the statutory minimum only because it began at a higher level. So this defendant, who originally was facing a guideline range of 135 months to 168 months in the government's hypothetical, was given a 100-month sentence due to his cooperation, but should now have that sentence reduced to 89 months. Compared to Mr. Wren and Mr. Moten, who were originally faced with 121 to 151-month guideline range, based on their lower drug quantities. They originally received sentences of 100 months due to their cooperation, and the government states that they should remain at 100 months. There should be no additional benefit, and their sentence should in fact be higher than a defendant who actually committed a more serious crime and whose original guideline range was 135 to 168 months. Now, the purpose of the newly amended guideline ranges and the new commentary that corresponds with those guideline ranges is to address an unwarranted disparity that previously existed, not to create new disparities. And the Commission effectuated that purpose through its new commentary, which refocuses a district court on the offense level and criminal history categories that define an applicable guideline range. Now, this court has not previously had occasion to deal with those new commentary. They've only been in effect for less than a year. But that commentary's focus on those two components, the offense level and criminal history categories, is consistent with providing the benefit of a reduction to all cooperating defendants, regardless of where their guideline range now ends up, and regardless of whether their guideline range now falls below a statutory minimum that did not, in fact, constrict their original sentence. It's consistent because any effect of a statutory minimum on a guideline range comes after the offense level and criminal history category have already been determined. United States Sentencing Guideline Section 5G1.1, which the government relies on to constrict the defendant's new guideline ranges, does not in fact change the offense level or criminal history category relevant to either Mr. Wren or Mr. Moten. Another guideline provision.
Well, I understand your argument rests on guideline 1.1.10.2a, which seems to say just take the amendment to the guideline and plug it into the old calculation while making no other changes. That, it seems to me, produces different kinds of results depending on whether the old calculation had included the mandatory minimum as the guideline range. I mean, you're lucky in a way that both of your clients' guideline ranges was above the mandatory minimum. What What concerns me is how the other courts of appeals are dealing with this problem. There are a bunch of cases out there where the old guideline range was the statutory minimum, and then the make no other change rule means it stays the statutory minimum. Have you found other cases where the old guideline range was above the statutory minimum, that is, this situation?
I have not, Your Honor. And the only case that I have found in all of my research that even deals with this issue at all is the United States versus McLean case, which is cited in the reply brief. And in that case, the
McLean
Sixth Circuit...
McLean is one of the cases where the old guideline range was the mandatory minimum.
Yes, Your Honor. However, and for that reason, the majority opinion did not even deal with this issue at all. But the dissent did give some consideration to what would occur.
If your principal reliance is on a dissenting opinion, you've got a weak position.
Your Honor, I don't think that that's where we are relying. In fact, there really is no authority out there telling this court how to interpret the new guidelines, because that has not been done yet. However, that is the only judge who seems to have even undertaken...
1B1.102A is not new. That's been around for a long time, hasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. The part that is new are the two key provisions that are new are, one, the focus on the offense level and criminal history categories, and two, the specific inclusion of defendants who received a sentence below an otherwise existing statutory minimum for their substantial assistance as eligible for a comparably reduced sentence. Now, to the beginning of Your Honor's question, I think that the fact that these two defendants ended up above the guideline range in their original sentencing is not just a matter of luck, but really changed the way that the parties would have interacted with each other. If there had been an additional consideration at the time of the original sentencing in which the parties had to include 5G1.1 or include the statutory minimum as part of their original bargain, they could have changed the bargain to reflect that. These parties did not actually have the opportunity to do that. And in fact, it would be very unlucky if the fact that they were deprived that opportunity in the original sentencing would mean that they would now be deprived of receiving any benefit when the commission has clearly intended that parties who receive sentences below the statutory minimum should receive a comparable reduction. And so that portion of 1B1.10B1, Your Honors, is consistent with the defense position because it is, in fact, the best way to approximate the bargain. By leaving all other considerations the same, as in not adding to the calculation Section 5G1.1, we are best approximating what the parties were doing at the time of the original sentencing, which was determining a level of departure from the guideline range, not from the statutory mandatory minimum. Forcing those parties to now stay at a departure from the statutory mandatory minimum actually limits the benefit of their original bargain, but for the defendant, such as the government cites in its example, increases the benefit of their original bargain. That is an arbitrary distinction, Your Honor. The fact that the statutory mandatory minimum played no role in the original sentencing makes now limiting the benefit of the reductions arbitrary. And that is an unwarranted disparity that cannot be introduced by the new guidelines, when the purpose of those guidelines was to avoid disparities in crack cocaine sentencing.
Did you notice the citation to U.S. versus Guyton in the 28J letter?
Yes, Your Honor, I responded to that as well.
Oh, okay, I haven't seen your response. What did you say about it?
Your Honor, there are two main things. The United States versus Guyton case was actually a case in which the defendant was a career offender under the guidelines. And so his original plea bargain had actually been a motion under the guidelines, a 5K motion under the guidelines for departure from the guideline range, which was determined by the career offender guideline, not by the crack cocaine sentencing guidelines. So that case is an opposite here. We're not dealing with an offense level and criminal history category that were altered by the career offender. We are dealing with two parties who did bargain for departure from the guideline range that existed at the time of the defendant's original sentencing, more similar to the case of Freeman versus the United States, the Supreme Court case, in which the parties agreed to a particular sentence in relation to the guideline range that existed at that time.
All right. I didn't mean to take your time.
Thank you, Your Honors. If there are no further questions, I will reserve my time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Counsel. Ms. Crimmins.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Emily Crimmins on behalf of the United States. We agree that the defendants were eligible for a sentence reduction under 3582C. However, the district court correctly denied their motions because it correctly determined that the statutory mandatory minimum affected the bottom of the defendant's applicable guideline range, or in the case of Mr. Moten, was the applicable guideline range.
Okay. Look, counsel, here's what concerns me about your position and the district court's. If you look at the end of the description in 2B1.10B1.
Yes, Your Honor.
The last sentence says, the court shall substitute only the amendments listed in subsection C for the corresponding guideline provisions and shall leave all other guideline application decisions unaffected. So if you substitute the amended guidelines for the old ones, you now end up with a new guideline range that is below the mandatory minimum. What the district court did, what you argue is proper, is then to go back and renorm it up to the mandatory minimum. And my question to you is how that's consistent with the last clause in this language, which says, and shall leave all other guideline application decisions unaffected. That renorming is something that wasn't done the first time.
Your Honor, our position is that this last sentence still applies because when the original applicable guideline range was determined, that step 8 of section 1B1.1A that we argue says take into account the statutory mandatory minimum still applied. However, the mandatory minimum
wasn't done because the range for both of these defendants was above the mandatory minimum. So when you look at the prior guideline, it's not affected by the rule, if the range is below the mandatory minimum, then use the mandatory minimum as the range. So we've got a range of, say, 121 to 151 months. You now plug in the new range. It ends up below the mandatory minimum. And the last clause, you know, just giving it a natural language reading, says leave all other guideline application decisions unaffected. And you want the judge to take another step, which is to go back and boost it up to 120.
I would argue that what we are doing is asking the court to apply the same step that was applied the first time, and while at the original sentencing it did not affect the guideline range, here it does. So the district court is not applying a step that was not applied before. It is just that the effect of that step.
Well, let me read the language again. Leave all other guideline application decisions unaffected.
Correct.
One of the decisions made at the time of the original sentencing was not to set the mandatory minimum sentence as the guideline range. That is not to do that. And you say now the judge should go back and reverse that decision. I don't see how that can reasonably be described as leaving it unaffected.
Your Honor, I would state that the district court, it wasn't that he decided not to apply the mandatory minimum. It was that the mandatory minimum was 1 month below the guideline range. So that mandatory minimum was still there. And if you, at 5G 1.1, I believe it would be subsection C, it states, in any other case, the sentence may be imposed at any point within the applicable guideline range, provided that the sentence is not less than any statutorily required minimum sentence. So the district court essentially applied 5G 1.1C and imposed a sentence that was within the applicable guideline range that sentence was above the statutory mandatory minimum. So therefore, the district court applied all of the 8 steps of section 1B1.1A to determine the defendant's applicable guideline range. And if the court were to decide that somehow step 8 or the implication or application of the statutory mandatory minimum does not or is a new step, that would be contrary to subsection A in section 1B1.1. It states that step 8 talks about applying the sentencing requirements that are listed in parts B through G of chapter 5, which includes 5G1.1 and thus triggers the statutory mandatory minimum. I would submit, Your Honor, that if the court decides that in order to comply with the last sentence of Section 1B1.10B1, that the mandatory minimum does not affect the new guideline range, such a decision would fly in the face of this court's decisions in cases such as Poole, where the statutory mandatory minimum applied regardless of any type of motion for a departure under either 3553E or Section 5K1.1. And the...
I'm lost. There was, in this case, a motion to give a sentence below the statutory floor.
Yes, there was.
And that was actually done originally.
Yes, it was.
And then the application note to the guidelines has instructions for what's now supposed to happen when the guidelines are amended retroactively, and the instruction is give a proportionate reduction. But on your view, that instruction isn't to be carried out. Instead, there's to be no reduction.
In this case, Your Honor...
What you want us to do first is disregard the actual language of the guideline and then take the language in the application note and ensure that it never applies to any case. Isn't that problematic?
Your Honor, that is not our position in this case. If it was, it would be problematic. However, we...
It's your position in the case. Otherwise, you'd be supporting the request for reversal.
No, Your Honor. We agree that the defendants here were eligible for a reduction. However, since their guideline ranges changed from 121 months to 151 months to 120 months...
The position is they were therefore not eligible for a reduction.
Because the percentage of the reduction was the same as what was originally applied. We agree that their applicable guideline range has changed. That's undisputed. However, we disagree on how to calculate their new applicable guideline range, and then that, in turn, under 1B1.10B2B, determines the extent of any reduction that they are eligible for. And here, in 1B1.10, subsection B1, it states that the court shall determine the amended guideline range that would have been applicable to the defendant. If we look at application note 1A to that division or provision in the guidelines, it states that the applicable guideline range is the guideline range that corresponds to the criminal history category and offense level determined in section 1B1.1A. And looking back at 1B1.1A, that includes 8 steps, which requires or, you know, includes the application of the statutory mandatory minimum in that 8th step. And there's also further clarification there, because in the definition it states that the applicable guideline range is determined before consideration of any departure provision in the guidelines manual or any variance. And those two possibilities are considered in 1B1.1 subsection B and subsection C. We believe that that supports our argument, then, that step 8 applies to determine a defendant's applicable guideline range on the basis of an amended guideline, and in this case results in the applicable guideline range of, in the case of Mr. Wren, 120 to 125 months, and in the case of Mr. Moten, 120 months. I would like to respond to opposing counsel's argument on our example that was given on the last page of our brief and how that is an arbitrary distinction. I would argue that that is not arbitrary there, because in our example, the defendant was given a bigger percentage reduction at his original sentencing hearing. So the fact that that bigger percentage of reduction perhaps shows a greater level of cooperation, or that the government, in its opinion, and the district court agreed then, that defendant warranted a lower sentence. And so in that case, the statutory mandatory minimum applied in both situations, when the defendant was originally sentenced and when the defendant came up or filed a 3582C2 motion. And the only reason that the defendant received a greater reduction below the statutory mandatory minimum and below his original sentence was because of the size of the original departure. If there are no further questions from the court, the government would submit that the district court's decisions to deny the 3582C motions should be affirmed.
I like your comment on Judge Merritt's dissent in the McLean case, Judge Eichenberg is certainly right that the dissent is not overwhelming authority, but Judge Merritt, I think, is a very thoughtful jurist who's been around for a long time, and I tend to think his views are worthy of some attention. So I'd like to hear what you have to say about it.
Certainly, Your Honor. As Judge Easterbrook pointed out, Judge Merritt was in the dissent, so his viewpoint did not garner the support of other judges. And then there's additionally, the Third Circuit in U.S. v. Doe has addressed the similar argument that the defendants raise here and has decided that to determine a defendant's applicable guideline range, we must consider the statutory mandatory minimum. The 11th Circuit did the same thing in the recent case of United States v. I believe it would be LaBerse. Both of those cases are cited in our briefs. And with those cases and then also the amendment to the application note in Section 1B1.10 that clarifies that an applicable guideline range is determined pursuant to all of the provisions in Section 1B1.1a, we believe that refutes the defendant's argument that somehow Step 8 is removed from the calculation of a defendant's applicable guideline range or just simply goes away in the face of a Section 3553E motion or a Section 5K1.1 Rule 35B motion. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Ms. Prasad?
Very briefly, Your Honor, I would just like to touch again on that point where the government is saying that in its example, that defendant was originally given a greater extent of cooperation benefit. Yet what they want to do is now increase that defendant's cooperation benefit, which was originally a 26% reduction from their original guideline range, to now becoming a 34% reduction from their original guideline range, whereas Mr. Wren and Mr. Moten should be capped at their original 17% reduction from their guideline range and essentially no eligibility for a reduction. And one last point, Your Honors, that the Doe and Liversy cases did not actually deal with the considerations raised in Judge Merritt's dissent in that Sixth Circuit opinion. And those cases did not have occasion to deal with the new commentary that specifically, as Judge Easterbrook has pointed out, make these defendants eligible for reduction. If Your Honors have no further questions, I ask that this Court remand this case. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. Our final case of the day.